I was told when I was invited that, which I already knew, you don't have to talk about moral philosophy to the Moral Sciences Club. But nonetheless, my topic today is in moral philosophy, though I should confess that I'm only an occasional moral philosopher. The ethical views of two of my teachers, Jonathan Dansey and John McDowell, made a big impression on me early in my philosophical life. And though most of my work has been in Russian philosophy, philosophical psychology, I guess, and most recently philosophy of education, I have throughout my career written occasional papers in and on the style of ethical thinking that first emerged in the mid-1970s in the writings of McDowell and David Wiggins, and on forms of particularism that owe a great deal to it. But it's not just that I've got a kind of sideline in a certain area of meta-ethics, for there's a sense in which this style of thinking is a presence, sometimes a phantom presence, in my writing in other areas. So I thought that almost 40 years after the emergence of this approach, it was time for me to step back and reflect on its character and significance. So that's what I propose to do this afternoon. I'll first characterize the position and consider whether it should be seen as opening up or as drawing in the horizons of moral philosophy. I'll then explore how the view might be developed, and that will lead to a discussion of moral education. So here's the Wiggins-McDowell view, stated in five theses. So the first is that moral thinking can disclose to us how things stand morally. I can judge that some course of action is morally wrong, or that a certain practice is morally praiseworthy, and be right because that course of action is indeed morally wrong, and that practice is indeed morally commendable. Moral judgments can admit of truth and falsity, and we can be justified in believing them in a way that licenses talk of moral knowledge. Second, a person's recognizing the morally significant features of some situation can be sufficient to motivate her to act. Thus, Humeans are wrong to declare belief motivationally inert. Three, moral properties and states of affairs, that's to say considerations the obtaining of which constitute moral reasons, are genuine constituents of the world. It's mere scientism to hold that natural science is the ultimate arbiter of what exists. We should reject scientific naturalism and admit that a feature of the world can exist objectively, even though it is also subjective or anthropocentric in character, in the sense that only agents equipped with appropriate sensibilities can discern its presence. Thus, the distinctive local perspective of an agent need not distort her understanding of reality. On the contrary, it can disclose what is objectively real. Indeed, possession of the relevant perspective is a precondition of rational thought and discourse in domains such as morality. Four, the relevant moral sensibilities must be understood holistically. They inform or are jointly constitutive of a moral outlook. This outlook resists codification. Many things matter morally. The view is resolutely pluralistic, and how they matter depends on circumstances and context. Hence, moral judgment cannot be wholly anticipated by rules. And five, to understand moral thought and action, you must be party to the moral outlook or inside the moral point of view. This is true at the level of morality as such. A radical moral skeptic or amoralist cannot be won over by arguments or examples that do not presuppose the moral point of view. Rather, he must somehow be brought inside the moral outlook, for only then will its claims appear compelling. It's also true of particular thick moral concepts, the use of which will be perspicuous only to those who share the relevant perspective. So that's the view in five theses. The view, which has affinities with Aristotelian virtue theory, with Wittgenstein, and to some degree pragmatism, is sometimes described as a form of moral realism. But this term is endorsed by neither McDowell nor Wiggins. McDowell, true to his Wittgensteinian sensibilities, resists any positive appellation, preferring anti-non-cognitivism. Less elusively, Wiggins embraces cognitivism, but this is equally unhappy, I think, since it suggests an emphasis on cognitive as opposed to emotional states, which sits ill with Wiggins' general approach. So I'm not going to venture an alternative, but speak simply of the view. And I'm not going to attempt to defend the view from its rivals, or to explore their similarities and differences, for example, with the view and something like Simon Blackburn's expressivism. That's something that we or others more expert than I am can take up in discussion. So I want to ask whether the view broadens or narrows the horizons of moral philosophy. I mean, it's sometimes heralded for opening up new vistas by removing the light-obscuring obstacle that was the prevailing non-cognitivism. But it might be argued that the McDowell-Wiggins approach really serves to rein in the aspirations of moral philosophy, and this for two reasons. First, some thinkers, indeed many moral thinkers, look to moral philosophy for answers to moral issues. McDowell and Wiggins, in contrast, are sceptical of moral theory's pretensions to resolve first-order moral problems. They seem to represent philosophy's concerns as meta-ethical, not moral. As far as deciding what to do goes, philosophy leaves everything where it is. And second, thanks to the influence of Wittgenstein and Strawson as well, I think, neither McDowell nor Wiggins sees metaethics as building constructive or systematic philosophical theories. Rather, metaethical reflection aims to protect our ordinary ethical conceptions, particularly in the face of philosophical efforts to undermine or revise them. So, to sort of illustrate this point, it's sometimes said, I think by David McNaughton in his book Moral Vision, and by others, that the defense of thesis one, the one about truth and knowledge, takes the form of an argument from moral phenomenology. The argument goes like this: when we deliberate morally in hard cases, we understand ourselves as trying to discover what to do, to conform our thoughts and actions to moral demands that we take to obtain independently of what we here and now desire. The character of such experience discloses the aptness of talk of moral truth and falsity, knowledge and ignorance. Okay, but this is not so much an argument for thesis one as an assertion that the thesis is consistent with our everyday experience. All the argument comes in fending off reasons to think everyday experience is misleading. The McDowell-Wiggins approach, it might be thought, turns moral philosophy into an exercise in descriptive defensive metaethics, designed to protect the space of moral reasons as we ordinarily take it to be, and thus it narrows rather than broadens the horizons of moral philosophy. Now, that reading is not entirely unfair to McDowell, but I don't think it captures the spirit of Wiggins's thought. The reading trades on two dichotomies, the first between moral theory versus metaethics, and the second, therapeutic versus constructive philosophy. But neither dichotomy is as exclusive as might appear. In both cases, there's plenty of middle ground, and this Wiggins contrives to occupy. It's true that the touchstone of Wiggins's approach is respect for ordinary experience. He enjoins us to preserve, this is a quote which I think is on the handout, enjoins us to preserve for some unsanctimonious, unmysterious species of ordinary morality the main features of the picture that morality has of itself, and refrain from any systematic or philosophical redescription of the actual purport of the claims that it advances. And this includes recognizing that when we deliberate morally, we understand ourselves as trying to discover what to do to conform our thoughts and actions to the requirements of morality. But at the same time, Wiggins acknowledges other contrary dimensions to moral experience. For example, it's not uncommon to feel doubt, not just about some particular moral decision or norm, but about morality as such, about its relevance, authority, and universality. Moral skepticism is not just a philosophical possibility. Ordinary morality can lose confidence in itself from within. In this regard, I think moral skepticism and general epistemic skepticism are on a different footing. Wiggins therefore enjoins us to, and I quote, allow all the room to which they are entitled for certain sorts of doubt that cannot help in real life but impinge upon practice. In the aspiration to attain a clear meet between particular philosophical doubts about morality and particular doubts we are actually prone to about how to see the human world. The implication is that philosophy hasn't so far achieved the right meet. This doesn't entirely undermine the appeal to moral experience to support thesis one, but it turns it from a mere assertion of phenomenological fact into an expression of moral optimism, which philosophical reflection must aspire to vindicate as we, quote, achieve mutual transparency between philosophy and practice, the transparency of practice to itself and its claim to truth. Wiggins's distinctive conception of the relation between philosophical and everyday consciousness is manifest in his way of developing the view. While McDowell, true to his Wittgensteinian quartism, eschews constructive endeavours, deploying philosophical argument to clear space for us to say what, in his view, it comes naturally to say once philosophical illusions and anxieties are exorcised, Wiggins, in more pragmatist style, looks to philosophy to enrich and support our everyday understandings, as they in turn constrain and inform philosophical inquiry. Thus, Wiggins is willing to say rather more than McDowell on such topics as truth and moral judgment and the genealogy of objective value, and to say it in far less defensive a tone. So, as I've discussed Wiggins's account of value, as he develops it in his paper A Sensible Subjectivism in a recent publication, I shall pass over it here, except to observe that he attempts to show, in a way inspired by Hume, how our natural propensity to react favourably to some properties and disfavourably to others could evolve and refine itself so that, first, particular kinds of response are called forth by particular properties, and second, a discourse emerges about whether such and such responses are apt to or merited by such and such properties. In this way, objectivity is said to be born of and cohabit with subjectivity. This isn't constructive philosophy as McDowell understands it, but neither is it merely a therapeutic exorcism of conceptual confusion. Something similar can be said about Wiggins's examination of moral truth, about which I will say more. Wiggins identifies five marks of the concept truth, gleaned by reflecting on the commitments of what he takes to be our best philosophical attempt to elucidate the relation of truth, meaning, belief, and understanding, namely a Tarski-style approach, itself at all points held responsible to our everyday modes of thought and talk. So these marks of truth include, firstly, that truth is a primary dimension for the assessment of beliefs. If X1 is true and X2 is true, then their conjunction is true. If X is true, then X will, under favourable circumstances, command convergence. So talk of convergence evokes Peirce, a thinker Wiggins admires, but Wiggins has no confidence in speculation about the end of inquiry, preferring to insert in its place an idea which he thinks Peirce should have endorsed, namely that where X is true, its truth will figure in the explanation of the convergence in belief that X. The notion of convergence can't substitute for the idea of how things are, for only a convergence explained by how things are is consistent with the notion of truth. So for Wiggins, the cogency of thesis 1 depends on whether the beliefs that inform and are exemplified by moral practice exhibit the marks of truth. The claim that they do must reckon with three considerations. First, morality is a domain in which concepts and claims are often essentially contestable. That is, reasoned dispute about them can continue without prospect of closure. Second, objectivity in evaluative discourse is consistent with the underdetermination of practical judgments. We can agree on how the values lie, while the question of what to do remains open. And third, this is consistent not only with the pluralistic idea that there are many ways of living well and acting rightly, but also with the possibility of tragic situations which put moral thinking into disarray. These obstacles to convergence threaten thesis one. Wiggins' response is interestingly not really to counter by argument, but to affirm a kind of speculative optimism. Thesis one will be vindicated just in case our actual moral practice sustains thought and talk, which suitably informed and fortified by philosophical reflection exhibits enough of the marks of truth to lend the thesis conviction. So I think Wiggins offers more than a merely defensive descriptive meta-ethics. For him, moral philosophy aspires to buttress and enhance the best of ordinary morality by defending it from attacks from without and within and encouraging informed self-critical discussion of moral life. While at the same time, our moral philosophical aspirations are hostage to whether moral practice can live up to the image philosophy paints of it. Moral practice and the practice of moral philosophizing offer each other the prospect of mutual vindication as well as the possibility of mutual embarrassment. This is not a view on which philosophy aspires to resolve moral problems, but neither does moral philosophy exactly leave everything where it is. It might reveal the myopia or incoherence of our moral concerns, just as moral reflection itself might disclose to us the ineptness of philosophical reflection. I can think of no better way to describe this stance than as a form of pragmatism. It's an unusually original vision, I think, and one that encourages sustained speculative reflection on moral theory and practice and the mirrors they hold up to each other. Okay, so this takes us to... This takes us over the page. the question then is what form further speculative reflection should take. So one obvious possibility is to explore thesis 4 with its Aristotelian and Wittgensteinian roots, particularly the idea that moral judgment cannot be anticipated by rules. And this is the way of particularism, the position most associated with Jonathan Dansey. So as many of my ethical writings are on Dansey's particularism, you might expect me to take this route. But I confess that I'm losing confidence in particularism as the best way to build on the insights of McDowell and Wiggins. I've long complained that Dansey's particularism is unduly narrow. First, notwithstanding the suggestion that things would be better morally if we were all particularists, the orientation of his view is almost entirely meta-ethical, with the focus on the epistemology and metaphysics of moral reasons. And second, particularism is obviously preoccupied with judgment about what to do in particular situations. But it has virtually nothing to say about other dimensions of moral life, such as the enduring commitments and concerns that are constitutive of moral personality. Philosophers with a fondness for principles can make sense of integrity and commitment in terms of allegiance to principle. This may be inadequate, but at least it's something. Particularists of Dansey's stripe, however, are pretty much silent on such matters. Although they are prone to invoke some rehabilitated notion of principle, say as a rule of thumb or as an expression of default values, the result, I think, is unsatisfying. So several of my papers press such objections, and I try to defend and develop particularism to meet them. But my concerns have gone unheeded and my efforts largely unnoticed, I think. So I figure that something in the spirit of particularism militates against broadening the position as I have recommended. Or maybe it's just that, you know, I've done a bad job trying to make these arguments. But maybe it's time to think differently. So Wiggins anyway shows us how we can embrace thesis 4 without fixating on principles. For him, the significance of the thesis lies in the idea that an ethos or style of moral thinking or a moral outlook informs moral judgment. Such an ethos cannot be codified into directives so that someone who is not party to it could act appropriately merely by following the directives in question. Here lies the shortcoming of a principled ethics that would rest everything on adherence to rules. But there is no reason why those party to the ethos should not express its character in the form of principles that can guide agents, inform moral instruction, and so on. It's just that agents will grasp the principles and deploy them appropriately only if they have a feel for the ethos that informs them. Wiggins develops this Aristotelian insight by invoking Ryle: adherence to principle is parasitic upon a form of practical knowledge or know-how. Even if it can be expressed propositionally in the form of directives, only someone with the relevant practical wisdom will understand how to apply them. Thus, we need to transcend particularism's preoccupation with situational moral judgment and countenance the broader tapestry of moral life, and do so in a way that illuminates the idea of ethos, that which informs and is expressed by a person's mode of moral living, her conception of how to live. And this is no easy task, for such an outlook is something lived, an embodiment of practical knowledge that's expressed in the living of it. So such a thing is not easily notated, that's the point. So how then to proceed? Now, one thinker from whom we might learn is Alice Crary. Alice Crary, whose Beyond Moral Judgment, her 2007 book, argues against a narrow preoccupation with the circumstances of judgment and for a broader conception of the subject matter of moral philosophy. An individual's conception of how to live, her moral presence in and bearing upon the world, encompasses far more than her application of specifically moral concepts in thought, talk, and action. As she puts it, quote, proper respect for challenges of moral conversation involves concern with nothing less than individuals' entire personalities, the whole complicated weaves of their lives. Inspired by Wittgenstein, Crary maintains that learning to speak is inseparable from the adoption of a practical attitude to the world, an attitude that bears the imprint of the speaker's individuality and is inseparable from the development of an individual moral outlook. When one learns one's native language, one does not just acquire a device for saying and thinking things. The acquisition of language brings with it a conception of the world, a conception that cannot help but be morally laden. There's no learning, say, the word cow without acquiring beliefs about cows, which might include cows give us milk, human beings eat cows, and so on, truths which have moral resonance. In acquiring those beliefs, the child acquires an attitude to cows that is morally significant. Moreover, on Crary's pragmatic, Wittgensteinian vision of language, competence with such concepts presupposes a network of beliefs and attitudes expressed in the child's active engagement with the world, so that the way she behaves in relation to and in discourse about cows has a moral dimension, whether or not she's thinking or speaking in ways relevant to moral judgment, as philosophers typically portray it. So Crary's position invites the objection that her view of the pervasiveness of the moral is philosophically overblown and morally exhausting. First, it's true that initiation into language is simultaneously habituation into a worldview that embodies a moral outlook, and that this outlook can find expression in thoughts that do not deploy moral concepts and actions that are not rationalized by moral concepts. Indeed, the significance of those thoughts and actions can be fully captured. Nevertheless, the significance of those thoughts and actions can be fully captured using moral concepts. We might say, for example, that in the course of acquiring the concept cow, the child has acquired an attitude to cows that is unjust or cruel. Here we use moral concepts to express our disapprobation, and if we're sufficiently articulate, we can express that disapprobation without remainder. Second, Crary charges her opponents, that's the sort of establishment of analytic moral philosophy, with moralism, accusing them of moral arrogance in narrowing the scope of ethical assessment and moral accountability. But moralism seems an equally apt description of her own view because it sees morality everywhere. In, I quote, gestures, manners, habits, turns of speech, turns of thought, styles of face. That's Crary quoting Cora Diamond. And in much else besides. It's true, of course, that one can find moral significance in a person's accent, choice of clothes, taste in music, food and wine, in the car he drives, the house he lives in, and so on. But it's surely better not to moralize all that unless something stands out that makes moral assessment unavoidable. I take that view not as insurance against moral criticism, but because too much moral scrutiny is burdensome and oppressive. But perhaps such objections, which were made, Crary's book was extensively reviewed, and objections like that, like those two, are frequently made. But perhaps such objections miss Crary's point, which is significantly to broaden our conception of the rationality at work in the moral dimensions of our lives. Responsiveness to moral reasons shouldn't be reduced to the exercise of a repertoire of moral concepts in a particular range of action settings. We need a less pointillist view of moral life. Responsiveness to reasons is grounded in sensibilities that express themselves in the flow of our activity, in our embodied engagement with the world, not just in a narrow class of particular doings. These sensibilities attune us to morally relevant properties in particular cases in the way recognized by the McDowell-Wiggins view, but they also guide our perception of the significance of enduring traits and ways of living. And that's an attractive view, and to embrace it isn't to deny